Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we talk to the creator of the popular blog Cake Rex, which highlights professional cakes gone horribly wrong. In our annual chat with a ghost hunter, we talk with Dale Kazmarek of the Ghost Research Society, and we'll hear the gruesome story of the Villisca Axe Murder House. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. They're found at birthday parties, wedding receptions, graduations, and all sorts of office events. Cake. People love cake. And people will come up with just about any excuse to have cake. Which brings me to this question. Have you ever ordered a cake from a bakery and realized it's totally not what you ordered? Maybe there's a misspelling or the decoration is way off, so much so that you have to stop and laugh. Well, there is now a blog that highlights these mistakes. It's called Cake Rex, and it's the brainchild of Jen Yates. She has just published a book about the blog called Cake Rex, When Professional Cakes Go Hilariously Wrong. It's from Andrew McNeil Publishing. I talked with her recently and asked her first what makes a good wreck.
Well, the simple criteria is anything that makes me laugh. But there's a lot of categories that break down from there. So it could be anything from a misspelling to an overly creative baby cake, to something that's a little creepy, unintentionally sad. There are many different flavors of cake wrecks.
Well, what has been your favorite all-time wrecks?
Well, I can't pick just a single cake. But probably my favorite type of wreck would be kind of what I call the misunderstandings, where there was a breakdown in communication and the baker either literally transcribed the order form onto the cake, or maybe, like we had one recently where it says on a whale cake, when instead it was supposed to just say on the whole cake. things like that. The flash drive cake was a great one, where somebody brought in a little thumb drive with a picture on it that they wanted printed out and put on the cake, and instead they just drew a picture of the thumb drive on the cake. That's a really good one, one of my favorites.
And, of course, misspellings are commonplace. People misspell stuff all the time.
Yeah, I cannot believe how many different misspellings of the word birthday are out there.
Or congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations is a little harder, so you could almost understand. But the birthday one really gets me.
Well, you've just published your first book called Cake Rex, When Professional Cakes Go Hilariously Wrong.
Yes.
So what can we find in the book?
You're going to find all the fun from the blog. It's mostly new content. 75-80% is all stuff that hasn't been on the website. And then there's some fun little reader stories, kind of behind the scenes of, you know, what happened to the person who got the cake and their take on it. There's a little bit on the cake on the site history, not a whole lot, just a little bit here. I wanted to give people a little bit more than what they would find on the site. You know, a little more information on me, some cake controversies, the people who get mad and why.
I got to hear some of these stories. Why do people get mad at the cakes?
Well, if you're the baker, you could probably understand why you might get mad. But surprisingly few. I mean, it's actually, considering how long the site's been around and the hundreds and hundreds of cakes up there, we've only had maybe half a dozen bakers ask us to take something that they made down. So that's pretty good.
Well, it seems, as you were saying, that everybody has a story of a cake gone bad.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's the American way. And it's kind of spreading, I mean, to other countries too. But America is certainly on the forefront of celebrating everything with cake. You see divorce cakes are hugely popular now. Cakes celebrating when your child is successfully potty trained. I've seen several of those. They all say way to go, with go in quotation marks. Everything justifies a cake now, evidently. And so the more cakes you order, the more likely it is that something's going to get fouled up. So we just see an avalanche of cake wrecks now.
Well, if you watch cable TV, it seems that there's evidence that we are becoming a cake-obsessed culture, like with the show Ace of Cakes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it seems like there's a new show every season now, or a couple new shows. Cakes are everywhere, and I can't complain because I love them. I try to watch them all. But yeah, America is just obsessed with cake right now. The timing is crazy.
Now, it seems with all this cake, and you do have a real love for cake, because not just you don't just show the wrecks, but you also feature some great cakes as well. Once a week, you bring out stellar examples of cake design as well. So you can tell that you really, you love cake and cake decoration.
I do, yes.
But it seems that you have one mortal enemy in the cake world. And that would be the cupcake cake.
Oh, the cupcake cake. Oh,
why do you hate cupcakes? Why do you hate cupcakes, really?
No, I don't hate cupcakes. I only hate cupcake cakes. There's a very important distinction there. A cupcake is just a little miniature cake in a wrapper. No problem there. A cupcake cake, however, takes all those lovely little cupcakes, glues them down to a cake board with lots of icing, slathers a huge amount of more icing on top, and then makes some ridiculous design out of them. So that's part of the reason I hate them right there, but mostly it's just they're messy and the shapes are just so ugly half the time. They try and make a round shape out of a bunch of small cupcakes and it never works. So it always looks like whatever they're making is smashed. You know, like we've seen a lot of apples for back to school. So all the apples have big scalloped edges, so they look like they've been run over by a steam or a big construction truck or something.
Well, recently you were featuring puppy dog cakes and kitty cat cakes, you know, very cute little things that they give in bakeries, little design elements. And then you have pictures of the same design elements, little face and tail, on the cupcakes, and it looks like it's a puppy skin rug.
Yes, it does. That's what the cupcake cakes do to the design. You take a perfectly nice design, put it on a cupcake cake, and it's just ruined.
So tell us a little bit about how Cake Rex, as a blog, got started.
It all started with a cake. It started with a forwarded email that a lot of people have now seen. It's now the cover of the book. It's the famous, it was called the famous Walmart cake. I can't prove that it came from Walmart, but that's what it was known by. And it says on it, "Best wishes, Suzanne. Underneath that, we will miss you." And so I call those literal LOLs now, where the baker literally transcribes what it says on the order form. But I got it as an email from a friend because she knew that I was taking a little cake class. She thought I would think it was funny, and I did. And then I started thinking, there's got to be more cakes out there with these kind of mistakes on them, and wouldn't it be funny to put them on a blog? And so a couple hours later, that's what I did. I started Cake Rex.
And how long has this been going on?
I started it in May of 2008, so about going on a year and a half.
Well, here's a question I have for you. Explain your mascot, which is a little baby riding a carrot. Explain that.
Ah, the carrot jockeys. Well, I can't explain the original cake, other than the fact that it exists. There was a cake with tons of little tiny icing carrots on them, and somebody took the little tiny plastic babies that I think you use in, like, baby shower games or something.
Well, that are king cakes from Mardi Gras.
Yes, king cakes. You're right. So somebody got a pack of these things and had one each one riding a little carrot. And I got this cake, and I had no idea what the backstory was. I just found the photo. And so I just said, you know, what is this? I wrote a little bit of commentary and called them the Naked Mohawk Baby Carrot Jockeys because they each have little mohawks. And people just loved it. They thought it was hysterical. It was one of the very first posts that was kind of a big hit with readers and still is to this day. And because people just kept referencing and going back to it, we just decided, okay, it's kind of the unofficial mascot now.
So how many submissions do you get on a weekly basis?
Ooh, on a weekly basis. Well, I think I actually have my sister-in-law, Anne Marie, helps me with all the email submissions and because it's so much work now downloading them all. And she estimated one time that we get 60 a day.
Wow. There's that much wreckage out there.
Well, at least people think there is. I think that some of my readers are a little hypercritical. Because sometimes I'll get a cake and look at it and try and figure out what on earth do they think is wrong with it. And then I'll have to read the email and they'll say, well, you know, the border was all wonky or look at that shade of yellow, you know, or something really subtle, which I think is pretty funny. We're raising cake awareness.
Well, you know, the funny thing is your website, I'm sure, inspires a lot of people to go and search out these things. In fact, my girlfriend, we can't walk through a grocery store without her looking at the cake aisle, the bakery aisle, you know, where all the cakes are at, to make sure there's no wreck in the midst.
Yes, I do the same thing. Isn't it awful?
Well, here's my question.
Any store we're in, we got to go look at the cakes.
Well, I mean, are we going to become so aware of wrecks that they might go away? I mean, are we sowing the seeds of a reckless future?
Wow. I don't know. That's getting a little deep. I mean, I could hope. I mean, I always claim that it wouldn't it be fabulous if bakeries banned cupcake cakes forever as a result of our efforts. In some ways, I mean, that would be a good after effect, right? If people start making better cakes. And also if the average cake consumer starts recognizing the talent that a good cake takes, you know, there are so many good artists out there on the front lines. And if I'm raising appreciation for what it takes to make a beautiful cake, I think that's a good thing.
Well, if people want to follow your blog, Cake Wrecks, or check out the book, where should they go to?
Online, it's just cakewrecks.com. That'll bring you right to it. And then the book is in Borders, Barnes & Noble. You can get it online. It should be getting into stores right about now, so you'll probably be seeing it on shelves soon.
Well, here's to a future of more great cake wrecks, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. Bring on the wreckage.
That was Jen Yates, who writes the blog Cake Wrecks. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Sam Patch went from working in the mills of early 19th century Rhode Island and New Jersey to become America's first daredevil. The guy jumped off really tall things for a living. He survived every time but one. More from independent producer Nate DeMeo from his podcast series, The Memory Palace.
There once was a man from Pawtucket. His name was Sam Patch. And when he was a little kid, he did what most little kids in Pawtucket, Rhode Island did in the early 1800s. He went to work. When boys and girls there turned 3 or 4 years old, they'd start out at the textile mills, picking up loose cotton that fell beneath the looms or got caught in the machines. As they got older, they'd work their way up the ladder to more demanding, more monotonous, and more dangerous work. 6 days a week, 12 hours a day in the winter, 14 or 16 in the haze and swelter of summer. And when Sam Patch was 7 or 8, he did what some of the men in the mill did. On his break, little Sam would follow them up to the top of the high bluffs by the waterfall that powered the mill. And he'd jump. He'd leap out over the rocks that could break your legs and plummet down into that one spot that was deep enough so he wouldn't break your neck. And for those few seconds, falling through the air and cutting through the cold churn of the Blackstone River, he'd be free of the mill. And then he'd swim to shore and dry off and go back to finish out the day and the lifetime that lay ahead of him inside. Soon Sam's favorite escape became the favorite escape of most of the other workers there. They wouldn't jump themselves, they'd sit down on the riverbank and eat their lunch and watch him do it. And Sam Patch found his calling and falling. In 1827, Sam Patch had been working in the mills for a decade and a half. He was 20. He was working in Paterson, New Jersey, and spending his lunch breaks leaping into the Passaic River. Each day a crowd would gather, and he'd jump, and he'd pass the hat and tell them to come back tomorrow and bring a friend, and promise that he'd jump from even higher. After a while, he couldn't climb much higher. On September 30th, 1827, Sam scaled the cliff by Passaic Falls, waved down to hundreds of people, and the newspaper reporters gathered below, and plummeted 70 feet. The next day, the papers called him the New Jersey Jumper. And Sam Patch left the mills behind for good. For 2 years, Sam Patch toured the Northeast. He jumped off flagpoles, off factory roofs, off ships' masts. If you could drum up a crowd and some cash and you had access to something really tall, Sam Patch would totally jump off of it. In the fall of 1829, he climbed out onto a platform 125 feet above the Niagara River, in the mist of Niagara Falls, and stepped off. He swam to shore, waved up to the 10,000 spectators screaming their appreciation up above, and collected his money from the hundreds of people who'd paid to sit in bleachers and get close to the action. Men admired him, women adored him, parents worried their children would want to be him. Sam Patch had become one of the most famous men in America by jumping off really tall things. It was a simpler time. But while that is a ridiculous route to fame, I'm not so sure it's any more ridiculous than having an inordinate amount of babies, or dating the divorced father of an inordinate amount of babies. America demanded more. They wanted more spectacular leaps, more danger. They wanted more from this man who had come from nothing. The man who had toiled in the same mills as they had and found a way out, who was once mired in the drudgery of an all-too-familiar existence and had literally risen above it. But one can only rise so high. Flyers went up around Rochester, New York during the week of November 7th, 1829. They promised that at 2 o'clock that Friday, the 13th, Sam Patch was going to make his final jump. He was retiring. He had taken his odd profession as far as he could, as far as anyone ever could. That cold Friday afternoon in November, Sam Patch crawled out on a slippery ledge in the middle of a waterfall, 99 feet above the Genesee River. He got to his feet and looked out over the crowd. 8,000 people had left their looms and machines at the mills and factories to cheer on one of their own. He shouted something down to them, though his words were lost in the roar of the waterfall. And he leapt and disappeared into the water below. The next spring, a farmer named Silas Hudson walked his cows down to a stream that ran through his property, some miles away from Rochester. He was hoping he'd find that the ice had thawed enough so his cows would have a place to drink. He found Sam Patch's body looking up at him through the thinning ice.
That was independent producer Nate DeMayo. You can hear his podcast at www.thememorypalace.us. Every October on this program, in anticipation for Halloween, we like to talk to a real-life ghost hunter. Dale Kaczmarek is one such man. He's the president of the Ghost Research Society based out of Oak Lawn, Illinois. He is also the author of Windy City Ghosts 1 and 2, A Field Guide to Spirit Photography, and Field Guide to Ghost Hunting Techniques. We last talked in 2007. I recently called him and asked him what he's been up to since then.
Well, we had an extremely busy year this year in 2009, which was probably our most busiest year so far. We traveled all across the country to different locations. We went to the Lincoln Theater in Decatur to do an investigation out there. We went to Waverly Hills Sanatorium down in Louisville, Kentucky. Mansfield Reformatory out in Mansfield, Ohio, and out to haunted Baltimore and Gettysburg all in one year. So we've been hopping all over the eastern portion of the country here, and we also had some investigations yet to come in the first week of October down in downstate Illinois near Alton, a place called the Cheney House.
Ooh, so tell us about this.
Well, the Cheney House, I don't know a lot about, except that I do know it is a very old historic building down there. It's been around since the 1880s, and it's currently the home of the County Historical Society right now as well. It's a old preserved home that they do keep the home in shape from donations and so forth, and they do have a lot of ghost hunting groups that go through there because there have been reports of activity in the building, including there are three floors, the main floor, the upstairs, and the basement. And apparently the basement has a lot of activity from a lot of people picking up EVPs or electronic voice phenomena, the idea of having spirit voices or sounds get on recording tape or digital tape of some kind. And a lot of people get that when they're doing experiments or doing EVP sessions in there. There have been reports of some activity of footsteps and an occasional apparition that has been seen. So we're going down there in October 10th to do an investigation down there. And then after we conclude that, the very next day, we're shooting down about 15 minutes south to Alton, Illinois, to look into the McPike Mansion, which is a very old home, very Victorian, kind of Gothic in style. And it's a very interesting place. We had some experiences there last time we were there. One of the main focuses of the investigation is the wine cellar in the basement. And a number of people have picked up strange orbs, strange mists and fog on their video cameras. We were in there several years ago with an entire group. We had night vision cameras set up, and we were just sitting very quietly, hoping to have something go on when we were there so we could get it captured on the video and the audio tapes we were running. And suddenly we heard all of us, even though you can't hear it on the audio portion of the videotape, you could clearly, the group clearly heard footsteps coming down the wooden stairs. And everybody, you can see everybody will turn on the tape and look to the staircase. And in fact, the owner of the home who was down there with us yelled up the stairs for Renee, because Renee had went upstairs earlier, and it was not her coming down. The footsteps stopped about halfway down, and then at that point, the metal door that goes into the wine cellar, which is never, ever closed, creaked, and you can clearly hear that creak of the door. So we all ran out there with flashlights, thinking that somebody was out and about, and of course there was nobody there. A few minutes later, that exact same thing duplicated. It's on the footsteps, and this time you hear the owner's voice a little bit more, a touch of fear or a touch of, you know, is that you, Renee? And then the same thing happens. That door creaked again. So we're trying to get down there again to set up some cameras and some of the various floors. There's one floor that people smell the scent of lilacs all the time, a very perfumey smell. There have been reports of footsteps and sounds as well in the home. So it's going to be quite a busy weekend for us in October.
Now, you've been doing this ghost hunting for over 30 years now, right?
I started back in 1975 professionally. My interest, of course, goes way back beyond that into my childhood and teenage years and so forth. I guess I could kind of blame my parents for starting me on this spooky hobby, because they often told me ghost stories when I was a youngster. And while even though I was scared, probably had a nightmare or two, I always wanted to hear another story. And later growing up in life, wanted to find out if some of these stories that I was told were simply, folk tales or legends or really true. One of the stories that I was told very often was this hitchhiking ghost story in Chicago, Resurrection Mary. And my parents, when they were first dating, before they became married, after the date, my dad would always like to drive around that cemetery at night, around midnight, looking for the ghost. Of course, my mom wasn't too happy about that. She was absolutely terrified of that. And my dad, I guess, is where I got that interest from. I take after my dad, I guess. Wanted to see it for himself. In fact, if he could, see this ghost or this beautiful lady that was allegedly walking along the roadway. They never saw anything, but these are the kind of stories I grew up with.
Well, in that time, in all this time that you've been ghost hunting, what has changed over those years, and what's the current trend? Are there some types of hauntings that are more prevalent now than there were 30 years ago? What's really changed?
Well, two things have actually changed drastically is people's attitudes towards ghosts. Ever since the advent of the movie Ghostbusters back in 1984, I saw a radical shift of attitudes and mindsets towards ghostly activity. Prior to that, if you talked about your spirit, or if you had a ghost in your house, or you thought you had a ghost in your house, you kind of kept it to yourself, because if the neighbors found out, if your boss found out, your friends found out, they think you were crazy, seriously. And I think since that time, since Ghostbusters and other movies that have come up, since they're Poltergeist, White Noise, Sixth Sense, other, well-made, dramatical presentations of ghosts have come out, people have become more at ease with telling their stories. They're not so worried about being laughed at or ridiculed as they might have been, say, in the 1970s or early 80s. So I see that as changing. I see more people coming forward with their stories. I also see the technology of ghost hunting actually come up to 21st century standards as far as equipment that people now use. State-of-the-art equipment is out there now that, again, is not true ghost hunting equipment, but can be adapted for that. And we've picked up a lot of new pieces of equipment, some gadgets throughout the years, including one of our most interesting pieces is a digital infrared trap camera. Basically, what that is normally used for is taking pictures of wildlife out there. You strap it to a tree, and it would be set off by motion. But because the flash is an infrared, there's no visible light coming out of it, it's ideally suited for ghost hunting, because not only at the same time the image is shot, which is a digital image, it'll show you the time, the date, the lunar phase, and the temperature at which the picture is taken. And that's very often very important in ghost hunting, is a sudden shift in temperature can often indicate that something is nearby. We've had great success with that on the last two investigations we've done so far, both at Waverly Hills and at Mansfield. At Waverly Hills, we were doing an experiment on the third floor, a floor that people say are children's ghosts. And people have put trigger objects out there, such as balls and toys, for ghosts to interact. And that's a new idea, too, that's only been circulating for the past 4 or 5 years, I believe. Are objects that ghosts can, they relate to. Children would relate to toys. In the case of going to Gettysburg, I try to get some authentic Civil War bullets to use as trigger items. We had set up a little toy truck, a remote control truck, and we were asking the ghost to move it about. We were using a very sophisticated EVP experimental device known as Frank's Box. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, one of our members of the group, had brought that along, and that box, the idea behind it is to get actual two-way communication with a ghost. You can actually hear the response rather than have to wait until you play back the tape later. And as we were attempting to have the ghost move this about, it sounded very much like the ghost said, "It's hard." And I had mentioned that right at the time I heard it. Rosemary then came back and said, "Well, if it's hard, why don't you bring some of your friends to help you move it around?" And at that point, I took this digital camera. I pointed it down the opposite hallway, right in line where we were at, snapped the picture. And when I got the picture downloaded to my laptop later that evening, there were four distinct shadows standing right there. So I guess he did bring his friends along to help.
Wow. Because I know last time we talked a lot about spirit photography and how that is changing. And has the transition to digital photography made that easier to capture spirit images?
I won't say easier, but the thing with the digital technology is you get that instant picture, which is always a plus. I mean, rather than have to, we still use 35 millimeters, but in 35 millimeter, you have to wait until you get the film developed to see if you got anything under. In a digital image, you're getting an instant picture, similar to the old Polaroids, except you're not using film. In that case, you can actually see what you've captured at that same time. And if you did capture something, of course, you can shoot more pictures in that area. So digital makes it easier, perhaps, to find a hotspot or an area where photography can be very rewarding. And not that the digital technology itself is better for ghost hunting. It's just that idea of that instant picture.
What is currently your most favorite haunted place?
That would be a hard one to answer. If I was to say in Chicago, it probably would be Bachelor's Grove. If I was to say out of state, at least of the places that I've been to so far, I would have to say Mansfield Reformatory. Mansfield Reformatory, by far, was one of the most interesting investigations that we were able to set up. We got a lot of interesting things happen to multiple team members out there throughout the evening. We were there until the wee morning hours, 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, literally all night, about 10 hours locked in this old prison, which was used in the movie The Shawshank Redemption. And we were setting up all types of cameras, tape recorders, digital trap cameras, setting up wireless microphones, infrared lights, using all different types of devices, doing EVP sessions, Frank's box sessions. We had a number of things happen to a number of people in the crew. We had we had one camera literally fall over twice for no reason. It was on a very steady tripod. There's no wind going through there. Nobody tripped on the wires. It fell over twice. We actually had a number of bangs and noises as though doors in the prison were slamming. Now, these are very, very heavy doors. They do have to, you have to exert some force to open these doors. And again, there's no wind going through here. It's a pretty closed-up environment. We were going through simply myself, my research assistant, Jim Graczyk, and another team member, Art Tram. We're just going around trying to elicit a response from the ghost, which is something that we've been doing more of. I think rather than simply set up a static night vision camera and hope that something walks through or waves at you, I think what you really have to do nowadays is you try to elicit a response by simply saying, is there anybody here? Who are you? Can you make a noise? Can you make a sound? Something of that nature. And we've had a lot of success in doing this. We had about approximately 30 people total in the group, but this being such a large prison, you almost find it lucky if you bumped into anybody else in the group. And in one particular instance, I know we were the only ones in the cell block. We had just walked in as we saw the other group walking out. So we were completely by ourselves. And as we were walking down the main floor, we definitely heard a sound overhead. Now, we're trying to amplify that and enhance the sound. It sounded like a cell door slamming. As we're walking back to where the cameras were set up, I clearly saw what looked like a shadowy person or shadowy image of a person standing on the second floor. With my naked eye, it didn't show up with the night shot camera, which is kind of interesting. So as we got to that section, I told my research assistant to snap a picture with that digital trap camera. And we got that image, and it was indeed a shadowed figure standing on top of that second floor. We also had one particular portion of the fifth floor of the western cell block where allegedly there was a ghost called the Running Man. Now, historical research is not real clear on this, but from what we've been able to gather from some old prison guards and some of the people who run the tours there, that there was a man, and there probably were several people killed in that prison during the time it was a prison, that had his throat slit over simply a pack of cigarettes. And he had his throat was so viciously slashed that when he ran, his head flopped and blood was gushing out. He was trying to run from his cell block over to the washroom area. And this is the same route that this running man is currently being seen today. So we set up our cameras to follow that route, and we knew about the time that that image, that apparition would be seen. We were up on the fifth floor getting ready to set up. We were filming the group as at the same time we were also filming an EMF meter, a tri-field meter, that was being held perfectly still. For some reason, this began spiking wildly, giving an indication of electromagnetic presence in the area. At that very same time, somebody from my group snapped a digital infrared picture with that trap camera, and we got a recorded temperature of 64 degrees. This was on the fifth floor of the building. Now, typically, heat rises, so that should have been the hottest portion of the prison. Ambient temperature all nearby throughout the evening was a constant 75 degrees. So we suddenly got a 64-degree drop. 64-degree temperature, which is an 11-degree temperature drop, up there on the fifth floor. At the same time, we had a tri-field meter spike. Leads credibility to that something, in fact, was going on up there at the time.
It's never a dull moment, is it?
It surely isn't. And I said, you know, the way we're doing investigations now, when you're doing an EVP session anyway, you're basically pretty much trying to get a response. You're asking questions. You're leaving some space, a blank tape for a response, you're asking another question. So the same thing as you're going around with the video camera, the same thing. You just ask, is there anybody here? What's your name? Can you make a sound? Can you make a noise? Can you move that cell door? And when you get noises, when you get responses, it's refreshing to have that sound, especially since you know that there's nobody in that building. There's no stray animals. It's not a wide-open building. It's locked up tight. There's no way for animals to get in. And you hear these footsteps, you hear these sounds, you see these things, these images. It's nice to know that at least somebody's out there is listening.
That was Dale Kaczmarek, president of the Ghost Research Society. The small town of Villisca, Iowa, isn't the setting you would expect for one of America's most sensational murder mysteries. But in that small town, there is a house where in 1912, an entire family and their two overnight guests were brutally murdered with an axe. It's ranked one of the 50 most paranormal homes in America. The home is now owned by Darwin Lynn. Independent producer Michael Paul Mason talked with Lynn and tells us the story of the Villisca Axe Murder House.
In the southwest corner of Iowa, there's a stretch of sparsely populated farmland between Des Moines and Omaha. There, you'll find the tiny town of Villisca, population 1,256. It's hard to believe that this small community was once the epicenter of one of America's most sensational murder mysteries. On Villisca's main square, there's an oddly marked storefront with a sign that simply says, Museum. A step inside, and you'll see a quiet, unassuming white-haired man wearing denim overalls and a ball cap. Some of his front teeth are capped with silver.
I'm Darwin Lynn, and I'm the curator of this museum, and it is a private museum. It belongs to my wife and I, and we also own the Villisca Axe Murder House and here in Villisca, Iowa, and Mike, I welcome you to the museum. On June 10th, 1912, there was a family of six people, the Moore family, Sarah, J.B., Josiah, and their four children, plus two overnight guests, were brutally killed with an axe. And the crime was never solved.
According to Darwin, it was a story almost lost to time.
Nobody talked about it, hardly at all. And my first experience of it was I was a sophomore in high school, and we had a good track team, and we were invited to the Drake Relays. We had a team fast enough that we could run, and of course, when you go to the Drake Relays, well, there's the parade, and we had our Villisca jackets on, and as we walked down the streets in Des Moines, all of a sudden, out of the crowd, here came this axe murder town, Villisca axe murder town, and I thought, what in the world's he talking about, you know, and it just kind of a shock to me, and you know, but that was really, I'll never forget that day. Just because from that day on, it didn't matter where I went. If I had an FFA jacket on or a Villisca letter jacket on, I was going to get stopped and asked about the axe murders.
Darwin isn't so much a museum curator or tour guide as he is the custodian, or you might say the guardian, of the Villisca Axe Murder House.
Martha and I, we didn't buy the house for anything paranormal. As you see what I have in here, I just hate to see anything destroyed. And I had fears that the house was going to be torn down and it wouldn't be here. You know, I mean, I thought, you know, from my times when I was younger and had a Villisca jacket on, I knew it had a name attraction. I knew people were interested in it. And I wanted to give it a try. And I kept telling Martha we ought to buy it, and anyway, we finally bought the house, you know, and it took me about 2 years to restore it, but it started coming back, you know, the minute the word got out that I was restoring the Axe Murder House, that's kind of a unique house to be, you know, and what really set it off was, without a doubt, it was the internet and the paranormal.
I asked Darwin if he wouldn't mind showing me the house, and he offers to drive me around town in his car.
I guess so.
He drives an avocado green sedan that looks kind of beat up and filled with junk. Darwin calls it an old work car. And when I get in, I sit on top of a crunchy yellow newspaper, and within just a minute's time, we're parked in front of a large building.
Anyway, right now, Mike, we're sitting right in front of the Presbyterian Church. Mm-hmm. And this is where they went to the Bible school program that night. And the Moore children came out of the church, probably here on this west door, and they went east down the street. And then I think Reverend Ewing and George J. Kelly, the traveling minister who was staying with Reverend Ewing, they went to the west.
That night, Darwin explained to me, the Moore family all went to church together, and while they were there, the Moore's daughter, Catherine, invited her two friends, the sisters Lena and Ina, to stay the night. Darwin pulls his car up about a block, and we're looking off to the left at Reverend Ewing's house.
And it was hot that night, and Reverend Ewing, over here in his family, they elected to sleep in a tent in the yard. And anyway, Kelly was in the house. Reverend Kelly was in the house by himself, and I think Kelly was probably up in that, see that balcony up there? There's a small balcony on the, kind of a porch like on the second floor of the house here. Two-story white house. But I imagine Kelly was standing in that balcony that night, and in his weirdness, see, he thought he had to commit the crime to get the inspiration for a sermon. So he was in jail for all kinds of weird stuff, and he was a known window peeper, womanizer, I think kind of a little pervert, really, you know, just a screwball. I think he's the one then that night he did trip down the street and looked in the window of the Moore house and saw the terrible thing.
Reverend Kelly is just one of the many who were suspected of killing the J.B. Moore family. Just down the block from the church is the home of the Iowa Senator Frank Fernando, or F.F. Jones, who, incidentally, was also a major suspect in the crime. Darwin pulls up in front of his house.
He spread his wealth around, that's for sure. He built this big house here on the left, and it was the biggest house in town at the time, and without a doubt, probably the nicest. I don't know just what you'd call it, Victorian. There's a lot of balconies and a lot of porch, chimneys and that. And really, a lot of people tell me they were more afraid of this house than they were of the Moore house when they were young.
So according to Darwin, the story of Senator Jones goes something like this. Jones once owned a store that sold farm equipment, and he actually employed J.B. Moore. That's the father of the Moore family. J.B. Moore quits working for Jones and becomes an early sales rep for John Deere farming equipment. He even sets up shop directly across the street. As you can imagine, the John Deere stuff began to sell, and that didn't sit too well with the senator. There were also rumors that J.B. Moore might have been fooling around with the senator's daughter-in-law as well. After Darwin fills me in on a couple other possible love triangles, he takes me for a drive up Villisca's largest street.
Anyway, we're going on Fifth Avenue here. This is the boulevard now, but at that time it was not a boulevard. And this is where they had the funeral procession, and they had two hearses in town, so Sarah and J.B. were in the hearses, and then they had six buckboard wagons, and they brought that was the long funeral procession up here to the cemetery. But now we're getting, getting close to the entrance here of the cemetery, this entrance here, up here on top of the hill, coming up on the Moore's graves here pretty quick. And, okay, right here then to the west here, here's the Moore's over here. And they tell me that stone was put there in the late 20s, early 30s, and they used the reward money, which is a tune of like $3,200 to put that up there. The stone with the names on them is a long flat stone on the ground there, and it's got the six Moores there. And anyway, then behind that is
Ross Moore, JB's brother, and his family. And then we come back to the east here a little bit, and we got the Brownstone down here, and that's the Stillinger family, and that was Lena and Ina, the two overnight guests that were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And
the headstone for Lena and Ina simply shows their first name and the years of their birth and death. Their story is every parent's nightmare.
That Monday morning, why Sarah Stillinger was concerned about the two girls that had stayed all night, Lena and Ina, and she rang the operator. And she asked the operator to ring the Moore House. And the operator said, "I can't ring the Moore House because everybody was killed there last night." And that's how she found out about her daughters.
What you're about to hear contains some pretty graphic descriptions. So you certainly don't want children, or even some adults, to hear this. Following the murders, all the bodies had to be identified.
See, they were all mutilated to the point that there was no identification. You know, you couldn't tell. Sarah Stillinger was the only, was the only one you could just right out tell who she was. And she took most of the blows to the top of her head. But the children, their faces were just brutally mutilated.
So, to be clear, from the neck down, all the bodies were left unmarred. At the time of the murders, Sarah Stillinger, Lena and Ina's mom, was 8 months pregnant. She was so psychologically traumatized by the death of her daughters that she lost the baby. Darwin points out a few other graves of notable Villiscans, like that of a man depicted in a World War II Pulitzer photo, and then we begin to make our way down to the Moore home.
The time of the killings, well, this was the east edge of town. Everything to the east here, we're coming up on the back side of the Moore property here. And on the east side of here at that time, this was pretty much all farm ground and pasture. To the south, there were a couple of houses that had been gone for many years. And to the north here was the Todd farm, and they had a famous barn. They boarded horses and that sort of thing. And I guess there was a man in the house in the barn that night, and he woke up and he looked out through a crack and he saw somebody go in the back door of the Moore house here.
We pull up to the house, and the place is hardly remarkable. In fact, it's tiny, and you can barely imagine that 8 people would have all been sleeping in such a small home. While we're standing in front of the house, Darwin takes me back to that terrible morning on June 10th, 1912.
Well, we're on the north side of the house right now, and right over here there was the pump there, and that's where the well was, property. And then we have the little coal shed to the west there, and that's where they took the axe out of. They used the Moore's axe. The gray house here, this is the Peckham house, and that's Mary Peckham. She noticed something wrong the next morning, and she's the one that alerted the people.
It's about 4 in the afternoon, and there's a slight chill in the air. The house has no electricity, just as it was in 1912, so Darwin grabs the lantern he's carrying, turns it on, and walks up the back porch to the Moore house and into the dim back room.
The reason the shades are all pulled and the doors are covered with cloth and that is, that's the way they found the house that Monday morning. So the killers had, or somebody had came along and pulled all the shades and covered all them. Actually, that door there had one of Sarah Moore's dresses draped on it.
There's a wood-burning stove and a washing table and an open door to the pantry. Every item is an antique. It's like stepping back 100 years in time.
From here, well, we can go into the parlor. And of course, this parlor had an entrance from outside, and the two front doors, and I believe this one was where the company came in. And we have a piano. There was a piano in the corner here. We know Sarah was a pretty talented lady, and she loved to play the piano. And she also was a fine artist. And you see bird nests around, Mike. That was a mother-daughter thing. That was Catherine and Sarah's thing. They, They studied birds and collected bird nests, things like that.
Darwin tells me that whoever the killer was, they simply left the axe leaning against a wall in the parlor. A doorway leads from the parlor into a small guest room.
There was sure no, there was no entry here by that window. There was no breaking and entering. JB's wallet, watch, and money was left on the kitchen table undisturbed. The only thing they took from this house that night was these people's lives. They were found in the bed. All the victims were found in the beds. And all the victims were found as if they were prepared for a funeral. And we have a little dilemma there, too, because all their faces was covered with cloth. But yet the cloth wasn't stuck to the wounds on the faces. So there was a time period there for that blood dried enough that it didn't stick on the wounds.
Darwin tells me that he believes Reverend Kelly might have been out on a late night Peeping Tom stroll, and that he may have peeked into the Moore's windows and saw the bodies. Kelly may have felt it was his duty to go inside the house and prepare it according to the custom of the day.
All the mirrors in the house were covered. And this, like I say, was a family thing, and to have come in the house and find them all done that way was pretty odd. You cover the mirror when you're grieving a loved one's death so you don't look at the mirror and show vanity. Or you cover the mirror so the spirit doesn't get lost in the mirror because the mirror's forever.
I should probably point out here that even though the house is undeniably creepy, I'm a pretty skeptical kind of guy. I do a lot of science reporting and don't really believe in things like ghosts or the supernatural, but I do tend to trust my senses, and my senses, by this point, are on full alert. We leave the sewing room, go back through the parlor and back into the kitchen, and the house seems to have grown quieter and darker.
So we can slip around here and head upstairs.
All right.
And this little crooked stairway here, it was a cheap house. It was a real modest house. And the first room here we're in is where Sarah and JB wasn't. Now, JB was the only one killed with the sharp edge of the axe. All the rest of them were killed in the flat edge and the blunt edge, so they were all plunged to death. Now, there is a photo of a man standing over the bed, and there's a man laying in the bed. But in the photo on the west wall here, the head of the bed, why, up in the ceiling, there's some big X's in the photo. And that's where the backswing of the axe chipped the plaster out of the ceiling. I go on the theory that the killers came in while they were at the Bible school program that night and knew the lay of the house. They came up here and they opened this door here that we into this closet. But this door has another door behind, and it goes into this attic over the kitchen. And I think they hid back in there, waited until they went to sleep, then opened, came out of this door, slipped out here, probably killed JB first, then killed Sarah. Then the rest of them was 12 years old and younger, under, you know. So, you know, the victims, as far as threatening them, was pretty well over with. But anyway, now, going into the south bedroom here, and this is where the four more children were, and now we got a big double bed here on the right side, and that's where Herman and Boyd were. And then over here on the southeast corner where we got the little bed, and that's where Catherine slept. And then we got the little crib like bed here, and that's where Paul was, youngest. And again, now in here, the axe marks were real erratic. They were just, there was no rhyme or reason to them.
The children's room is a sad place. The beds are empty and quiet. But apparently it's a bit more noisy at night. Paranormal investigators have recorded voices in this room, voices that belong to children.
Now let's just think back to the morning of June 10th, 1912, when Mary Peckerman got up early to do her laundry, and as she was putting her clothes on the line, she noticed this terrible stillness here. And what I mean by that, back then everybody got up at daylight and everybody worked, you know, and the children were up and around. She was really concerned when the Morse cow hadn't been milked. And so then she called to Ross Moore's house, J.B.'s brother, and she missed him. He'd already left for downtown. A little while later, she called down to the John Deere store, got a hold of a man by the name of Ed Sully, who worked for J.B.
Darwin says that it took a while for a local official to eventually wander into the house and discover the bodies. Everybody mainly stood outside and remarked how something must be terribly wrong there. Something still feels terribly wrong about the place. Someone did enter the home. Villisca's constable, Hank Horton. He went through the rooms on the bottom level of the house, and then he made his way upstairs.
Hank came into this room here, and he opened this window right here. And by that time, there was 10 or 15 people gathered outside in the yard, just out of curiosity. And he hollered out the window, "Good Lord, there's people dead in every bed."
After going through the story with me, Darwin tells me that he thinks that the children would have recognized their killer, and that's why their lives were also taken.
That's their story, and it gives me a reason for the crime, and it gives me a reason to kill the children. And without that, I don't have one. But I'm very open-minded, and if somebody comes with one that'll convince me that, you know, that's not it, well, I'll sure go along with it.
Has anything remarkable happened as far as, like, the, you know, supernatural phenomenon that people have reported that sticks out in your mind?
Well, there's... That door just banged, you know.
Yeah,
and there's lots of videos of the door opening, and they say that the children
were standing in the children's bedroom, and the closet door closes randomly. There's not a draft in the house, and there's no whooshing sound or anything like that. It just closes. I'll play it again for you louder.
Sure, I'll sure go along with it.
Has anything
when the door closes, Darwin doesn't even flinch. He says that kind of thing happens all the time.
See, kids, little kids are the ones that's convinced me there's something here because their minds are open, you know, and I've seen them play with somebody that's not here. I've seen them lay on the floor in the bed and pick up cover and play peekaboo to somebody that's not under the bed.
Darwin claims he never really thought much about the supernatural before. He was just kind of a pack rat, and he ended up collecting this house. But in becoming its owner, he's also been forced to accept that he might not understand the very thing he's responsible for protecting.
Oh yeah, I'm open to it, and I'm sure there's something here. It really gnaws on me that I don't know just what it is.
That feature from independent producer Michael Paul Mason. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.